food, but there's something uncommonly strange about the teacher. She says the same thing over and over.
That's how you teach little kids, said Celia.
Perhaps, said Tamlin. I'm not what you'd call an expert on education.
The next day went exactly like the first. If Matt thought he'd been bored before, it was nothing compared to writing the same letters, coloring the same pictures, and counting the same wretched beads and flowers all over again. But he worked hard to make Celia proud of him. Days 3, 4, and 5 passed in exactly the same way. Tamlin went outside and juggled weights. He dug a vegetable bed for Celia in the walled garden. Matt wished he could escape that easily.
"Who can tell me how many apples I have here?"
warbled teacher on day 6.
"I'll bet it's my good boy."
Matt suddenly snapped. "I'm not a good boy," he screamed. "I'm a bad clone, and I hate counting, and I hate you." He grabbed teacher's carefully arranged apples and hurled them every which way. He threw the crayons on the floor, and when she tried to pick them up, he shoved her as hard as he could. Then he sat on the floor and burst into tears.
"Someone isn't going to get a smiley face on his paper," teacher said with a gasp,
leaning against a wall. She started to whimper like a frightened animal. Tamlin thundered through the door and gathered teacher up in a bear hug.
"Don't cry," he said into her hair. "You've done very well. You've fixed something the rest of us hadn't a clue how to mend."
Gradually, teacher's breathing slowed, and the whimpering stopped. Matt was so startled he stopped crying. He realized something momentous had just happened.
"I can talk," he murmured.
"You get 2 gold stars by your name today, lassie," Tamlin said into teacher's hair. "You poor sad creature. I didn't know what I was looking at until now."
He gently urged the woman out of the apartment, and Matt heard him talking to her all the way down the hall.
"My name is Mateo Alacran," Matt said, testing his newly regained voice. "I'm a good boy."
He felt dizzy with happiness. Celia was going to be so proud of him now. He would read and color and count until he became the best student in the whole world. And then the children would like him, and they wouldn't run away. Tamlin interrupted Matt's ecstatic thoughts.
"I hope that wasn't a one-shot deal," he said. "I mean, you really can talk."
I can,
Matt sang.
"Wonderful. I was going bonkers with counting beads." The poor thing. It was all she knew how to do.
"She was an idiot,"
announced Matt, using Maria's worst insult.
"You don't even know what the word means," Tamlin said. "Tell you what, laddie, we've got something to celebrate. Let's go on a picnic."
"A picnic?" echoed Matt, trying to remember the meaning of the word.
"I'll explain it to you on the way," said Tamlin.
Chapter 8. The Egypt in the Dry Field. Matt was wildly excited. Not only were they going on a picnic, but they would travel by horseback. Matt had seen horses from the windows of the little house, and of course he'd seen them on TV. Cowboys and big, tough bandidos rode them. His favorite hero was El Látigo Negro, the Black Whip. El Látigo Negro was on TV every Saturday. He wore a black mask and rescued poor people from evil capitalists. His favorite weapon was a long whip, with which he could peel an apple while it was still on the tree. Matt was more than a little disappointed when Tamlin brought out a sleepy gray horse instead of the spirited steed El Látigo Negro rode.
"Be reasonable, lad," said the bodyguard, tightening the girths on the saddle. "We're after reliability, not speed. El patron wouldn't take it at all well if you were dumped on your head."
Once Matt was perched on the saddle in front of Tamlin, he forgot all about his disappointment. He was riding. He was high in the air, swaying along with the smell of horse all around him. He felt the coarse hair of the mane and pressed his ankles against the warm coat of the animal. After all those months without talking, Matt couldn't wait to catch up. He chattered about everything he saw. The blue sky, the birds, the flies buzzing around the horse's ears. Tamlin didn't stop him. He grunted, occasionally, to show he was listening, and directed the horse along a dirt path. They plodded through the poppy fields and gradually moved away from the big house toward the gray-brown hills that lay on the horizon. The first fields they encountered were covered with a mist of new leaves. These were the seedlings. Matt had watched the growing cycle from the window of the little house, and he knew what to expect. The older plants were larger and rounder, like small cabbages, and the leaves were tinged with blue. As they rode, the plants became larger, until they were as high as the belly of the horse. Buds opened into crinkled petals in a glory of white under the hot sun. A faint perfume hung in the air. They came to fields where the petals had fallen. These lay in drifts all over the ground, while the seed pods they left behind stuck up like green thumbs. The pods had swelled until they were the size of hen's eggs and ready for harvest. Matt saw the first farm laborers. He'd observed them before, but Celia had warned him to hide from strangers, so he hadn't watched them closely. Now he saw that both men and women wore tan uniforms and wide straw hats. They walked slowly, bending down with tiny knives to slash the pods.
"Why are they doing that?" Matt asked.
"To release the opium," replied Tamlin. "The sap oozes out and hardens overnight. In the morning, the workers scrape it off. They can collect from the same plant 4 or 5 times."
On and on the horse plodded. The fields shimmered with heat, and a sweet odor with something rotten at its core filled the air. The workers bent and slashed in a hypnotic rhythm. They didn't speak. They didn't even wipe the sweat off their faces.
"Don't they get tired?" Matt asked.
"Oh, aye, they do," said Tamlin.
At last the horse came to a deserted field. The plants were beginning to dry. A hot breeze rattled the leaves.
"Look, there's a man lying on the ground," cried Matt.
Tamlin halted the horse and got down.
"Stay," he ordered the animal.
Matt clung tightly to the mane. He didn't feel at all safe so far off the ground. Tamlin strode over to the man, bent down, and felt his neck. He shook his head and returned.
Can't we help him?"
faltered Matt.
"It's too late for that poor soul," grunted the bodyguard.
"What about the doctor?"
"I told you it's too late. You want to get your ears cleaned."
Tamlin hoisted himself back into the saddle and ordered the horse to go on. Matt looked back, tears stinging his eyes. The man was quickly hidden by the poppy plants. Why was it too late? Matt wondered. The man must be terribly hot, lying as he was in the full sun. Why couldn't they stop and give him water? Matt knew they had water. He could hear it sloshing in Tamlin's backpack.
"We could go back," Matt began again.
"Damn it!"
roared the bodyguard. He halted the horse and sat for a moment, breathing hard. Matt looked at the ground and wondered whether he had the nerve to jump off if Tamlin really lost his temper.
"I forget. Kids your age don't know anything," said Tamlin at last. "The man is dead. Heat or lack of water killed him. The cleanup crews at the end of the day will find him."
The horse moved on. Matt had even more questions now, but he was too unsure of Tamlin's temper to ask them. Why hadn't the man gone home when he got sick? Why hadn't the other workers helped him? Why was he being left out there like a piece of trash? All the while they were riding along a range of hills that bordered the fields. Now they turned off into a dry stream bed that led into the hills. Tamlin got down and led the horse under a cliff where it would have shade. Nearby was a trough and a pump, which he worked vigorously to bring up the water. The horse was sweating. Its eyes watched the trough, but it didn't move.
"Drink," said Tamlin.
The horse trotted forward and dipped its muzzle. It blew noisy bubbles as it drank ravenously.
"We'll walk the rest of the way."
"Can't we take the horse?"
said Matt, looking doubtfully at the stream bed snaking into the hills.
"It wouldn't obey. It's programmed to stay on the farm."
"I don't understand."
"It's a safe horse, which means it has an implant in its head. It won't bolt or jump. It won't even drink unless you tell it to."
Matt digested that idea for a moment.
"Not even if it's very thirsty?" he said at last.
"It was thirsty just now," said Tamlin. "If I hadn't told it to drink,
It would have stood in front of the trough until it died. Stay, he told the horse. Shouldering a backpack, he started up the dry stream. Matt scrambled after him. At first, the way wasn't difficult, but soon it was blocked by boulders they had to climb. Matt wasn't used to exercise, and he quickly found himself out of breath. He didn't stop, though, because he was afraid Tamlin would leave him behind. Finally, the bodyguard heard him gasping and turned back. He hunted through the backpack.
Here, drink some water. Have a bite of beef jerky, too. The salt will do you good.
Matt devoured the beef jerky. It tasted wonderful.
Not much farther, laddie. You're doing very well for a hothouse plant.
They came to a giant boulder that seemed to block the trail until Matt saw a round hole in the middle. It was worn smooth like the hole in a donut. Tamlin climbed through and reached back to help Matt. The scene on the other side was completely unexpected. Creosote bushes and palo verde trees framed a small, narrow valley, and in the center of this was a pool of water. At the far end, Matt saw an enormous grapevine sprawled over a man-made trellis. In the water itself, Matt saw shoals of little brown fish that darted away from his shadow.
This is what you call an oasis, said Tamlin, throwing down his pack and taking out food for the picnic. Not bad, eh?
Not bad, agreed Matt, accepting a sandwich.
I found this place years ago when I first started working for a patron. The Alacrangs don't know about it. If they did, they'd run a pipe in here and take out all the water. I hope I can count on you to keep the secret.
Matt nodded, his mouth full of sandwich.
Don't tell Maria either. She can't help blabbing.
Okay, said Matt, proud that Tamlin considered him responsible enough to keep a secret.
I brought you here for two reasons, said the bodyguard. One, because it's nice. And two, because I want to tell you a few things, without being spied on.
Matt looked up, surprised.
You never know who's listening to you in that house. You're too young to understand much, and I wouldn't say anything if you were a real boy.
Tamlin tossed breadcrumbs into the pool. The little fish rose to the surface to feed.
But you're a clone, he went on. You haven't got anyone to explain things to you. You're alone, in a way real humans can't understand. Even orphans can look at pictures and say, that's me ma, and that's me da.
Am I a machine? Matt blurted out.
Machine? Oh no.
Then, how was I made?
Tamlin laughed. If you're a real boy, I'd tell you to ask your big brother that tricky little question. Well, lad, the best way to describe it is this. A long, long time ago, some doctors took a piece of skin from El Patron. They froze it, so it would keep. Then, about 8 years ago, they took a bit of that skin and grew it into a whole new El Patron. Only they had to start at the beginning with a baby. That was you.
That was me? Asked Matt.
It was.
So I'm just a piece of skin?
Nah, I've gone and upset you, said Tamlin. The skin was what you might call a photograph. All the information was there to grow a real copy. Skin, hair, bones and brain of a real man. You're exactly like El Patron when he was 7 years old.
Matt looked down at his toes. That's all he was. A photograph.
They put that piece of skin into a special kind of cow. You grew inside. And when the time came, you were born. Only, of course, you didn't have a father or a mother.
Tom said I was puked up by a cow, said Matt.
Tom is a filthy little pustule, said Tamlin. And so is the rest of that family. If you quote me, I'll deny it.
He brought out a bag of trail mix and passed it to Matt.
To continue. Being a clone, you're different, and a lot of people are afraid of you.
They hate me, Matt said simply.
Aye, some do.
Tamlin stood up and stretched his big muscles. He paced back and forth on the sand where they were having their picnic. He hated to sit still for long.
But some love you. I'm speaking of Maria, and of course Celia.
And El Patron.
Ah, well, El Patron's a special case. To be honest, the number of people who love you is small, and the number who hate you is large. They can't get around the fact that you're a clone. It makes it hard to send you to school.
I know. Matt thought bitterly of Maria. If she really loved him, she'd take him with her, and not care about how the other kids felt. El patrón insists that you be educated and live, as nearly as possible, a normal life. The problem is no private teacher wants to teach a clone, and so the Alacrán's got an Egypt. Matt was startled. He'd heard the word so often, mostly from Maria. He thought it was only a swear word, like dum-dum or cootie face. An Egypt is a person or animal with an implant in its head, said Tamlin.
Like the horse? Said Matt, as a terrible thought occurred to him.
Correct. Egypts can do only simple things. They pick fruit, or sweep floors, or, as you've seen, harvest opium.
The farm workers are Egypts? Cried Matt.
That's why they work without resting until the foreman orders them to stop, and why they don't drink water unless someone tells them to. Matt's thoughts were whirling. If the horse could stand there and die in front of a trough of water, then the man, he said aloud.
You're bright as a button, lad, said Tamlin.
The man we saw on the ground probably lagged behind the other workers and didn't hear the foreman tell them to stop. He might have worked all night, getting thirstier and thirstier.
Stop! Shrilled Matt.
He covered his ears. This was horrible. He didn't want to know any more.
Tamlin was at his side at once. That's enough lessons for one day. We're on a picnic and we haven't had any fun yet. Come on, I'll show you a beehive and a coyote den. Everything lives around water in the desert.
They spent the rest of the day exploring the burrows, the crevices, the hidden layers of the secret valley.
Tamlin might not have gone to school for too long, but he knew a great deal about nature. He taught Matt to sit still and wait for things to come to him. He told him how to tell the mood of a beehive by its hum. He pointed out droppings and tracks and bone fragments. Finally, as shadows began to fill up the oasis, Tamlin helped Matt climb through the hole in the rock and return to the horse. It was waiting exactly where they'd left it. Tamlin ordered it to take another drink before they set off. The fields were empty, and the long shadows of hills flowed across the land. Where they ended, the late afternoon sun made the poppies glow with a golden light. They passed the dry field where the man's body had lain, but it was gone.
Teacher was an Egypt, said Matt, breaking the silence.
She was one of the brighter ones,
said Tamlin. Even so, she could do only one lesson over and over.
Will she come back?
No.
The bodyguard sighed. They'll put her at her work mending curtains or peeling potatoes.
Let's talk about something more cheerful.
Could you teach me? Asked Matt.
Tamlin let out a bellow of genuine laughter.
I could if you wanted to learn how to break desks with karate chops. I reckon you'll do your schooling off the TV. I'll be around to hang out the window by your ankles if you don't study.
Chapter 9. The Secret Passage. On the surface, Matt's life settled into a pleasant rhythm. He studied via distance learning over the TV. Tamlin sent off the homework. It came back with excellent grades. And Celia praised Matt lavishly. Maria praised him too when she visited. It didn't hurt either that Tom had lousy grades and managed to stay in boarding school only because Mr. Alacrán sent the headmaster a large donation. But underneath, Matt felt a hollowness. He understood he was only a photograph of a human, and that meant he wasn't really important. Photographs could lie forgotten in drawers for years. They could be thrown away. At least once a week, Matt dreamed of the dead man in the field. The man's eyes were open and staring up at the sun. He was terribly, horribly thirsty. Matt could see how dusty his mouth was. But there was no water anywhere, only the dry, rattling poppies. It got so bad that Matt demanded a pitcher of water by his bed. If only he could take that pitcher into his dreams. If only he could dream it there and pour water into the man's dusty lips. But he couldn't. And when he woke up, he drank glass after glass to get rid of the dry, dead feel of the poppy fields. And then, of course, he had to go to the bathroom. On such occasions, Matt would tiptoe past Celia's bedroom. He could hear her snores and across the hall Tamlin's thunderous reply. This should have made him feel safe. But Matt never knew just before he opened the bathroom door whether the dead man might be lying on the other side, staring up at the big light in the middle of the ceiling. Maria started bringing Furball on her visits. He was a shrill, rat-sized dog that forgot his house training when he got excited. Tamlin often threatened to suck him and the mess he deposited up the vacuum cleaner.
"He'd fit," he growled over Maria's horrified protests. "Trust me, he'd fit."
What Matt hated about the creature was everyone's assumption that he and Furball were the same. It didn't matter that Matt had excellent grades and good manners. They were both animals, and thus, unimportant. During Easter vacation, Tom said good manners were no harder to learn than rolling over or playing dead. Matt threw himself at him, and Maria ran shrieking for Tamlin. Tom was sent to his room without dinner. Matt wasn't punished at all. Which was okay with Matt, except that Furball wasn't punished for his crimes either. He couldn't understand the difference between right and wrong. He was a dumb beast, and so, apparently, was Matt. When Maria wasn't visiting, Matt amused himself by exploring the house. He pretended he was el Látigo Negro, scouting out an enemy fortress. He had a black cape and a long, thin leather belt for a whip. He skulked behind curtains and furniture, and he hid if he saw one of the alacrans in the distance. Felicia, Benito's, Stevens, and Tom's mother, played the piano in the afternoons. Her crashing chords echoed from the music room. She attacked the piano with a fervor completely different from her usual sluggish self, and Matt liked to hide behind the potted plants to listen. Her fingers flew from one end of the keyboard to the other. Her eyes were closed, and her mouth was pulled back in a grimace that wasn't pain, but something close to it. The music was wonderful, though. After a while, Felicia would run out of energy. Trembling and pale, she would hunch over the keys, and this was the signal for a servant to bring her a brown liquid in a beautiful cut glass bottle. The servant would mix a drink, Matt loved the clink of ice, and place it in Felicia's hand. She would drink until the trembling stopped. Then she would wilt over the piano like one of Celia's spinaches when Tamlin forgot to water the garden. Maids had to carry her away to her apartment. One day, Felicia didn't come at her usual time, and Matt hovered behind the potted plants as he worked up his courage to approach the piano. If she caught him, he knew he'd be banished from the room forever. His fingers tingled with the desire to play. It looked so easy. He could even hear the music in his head. Matt crept out of his hiding place. He reached out to touch the keys and heard Felicia's listless voice in the hallway. She was telling a servant to bring her a drink. Matt panicked. He darted into a closet behind the piano and shut the door an instant before Felicia came into the room. She immediately started playing. Matt sneezed from all the dust in the closet, but Felicia was making too much noise to hear him. Matt felt around until he found a light switch. It was a disappointing place. Sheet music was stacked against the walls, a heap of folding chairs filled up one corner, and it was so covered with dust and spider webs that Matt sneezed again. He rolled up a sheet of music and began sweeping off the inner wall, more for something to do than from any real curiosity. On the inner wall, under a knot of webs that would have made Dracula happy, Matt found another light switch. He flipped it on. He recoiled against a heap of music when part of the wall slid open and threw up a cloud of dust that made him choke. He reached for the asthma inhaler Celia insisted he carry at all times. When the dust had settled, Matt saw a narrow, dark hallway. He peered around the corner. An empty passage stretched both to the left and to the right. By now, Felicia had stopped playing the piano. Matt held very still, listening for the clink of ice in glass. After a while, he heard the maids carry Felicia away. Matt flipped the switch once more and saw, to his great relief, that the wall closed up again. He slipped out of the closet, leaving dusty footprints across the carpet, and was scolded by Celia when she saw the state of his clothes and hair. This was even better than an episode of El Látigo Negro, Matt thought, hugging the secret to himself. This was a place that belonged to him, alone. Not even Tamlin could find him if he wanted to hide. Slowly and carefully over the next few weeks, Matt explored his new domain. It seemed to snake between the inner and outer walls of the house. He found peepholes in the wall, but saw only empty rooms with chairs and tables beyond. Once, he saw a servant dusting furniture. A few of the peepholes looked into dark closets like the one in the music room. Matt didn't understand until one day, while feeling his way along the passage, his hand struck against another switch. He flicked it on. A panel slid open, just like the one in the music room. Matt's heart beat wildly. He could walk right into the closet. It was full of musty clothes and old shoes, but if he pushed them aside, he could get to the door on the other side. He heard voices. The doctor and Mr. Alacran were pleading with a third person whose replies were muffled. The doctor spoke harshly, bringing bad memories back to Matt. "Do it," Willem snarled. "You know you have to do it." "Please, father," said Mr. Alacran, gentler than Matt had ever heard him be.
"No, no, no,"
moaned Mr. Alacran's father. "You'll die without chemotherapy," his son begged.
"God wants me to come."
"But I want you here," Mr. Alacran pleaded.
"This is a place of shadows and evil."
The old man was clearly becoming irrational. "At least get a new liver," Willem said in his harsh voice.
"Leave me alone,"
wailed the old man. Matt retreated to the passageway and closed the opening. He didn't understand what the men were arguing about, but he knew what would happen if someone caught him listening. He'd be locked up. He might even be given back to Rosa. Matt made his way to the music room, and for a long time he didn't venture into the secret passage. He did, however, keep listening to Felicia's music. It was something that had gotten inside him, and no matter how dangerous it was, he couldn't go along without hearing it. One afternoon, Matt was alarmed to see the doctor arrive with Felicia's drink instead of a servant.
"Oh, Willem," she moaned as he mixed in the ice. "He doesn't talk to me anymore. He looks right through me as though I weren't there."
"It's all right," soothed the doctor. "I'm here. I'll take care of you." He opened his black bag and took out a syringe. Matt held his breath. The doctor had given him a shot when he was sick, and he'd hated it. Matt watched, fascinated, as Felicia's arm was swabbed and the needle jammed in. Why didn't she cry out? Couldn't she feel it? Willem sat next to her and draped his arm around her shoulders. He murmured things Matt couldn't hear. It must have pleased Felicia, because she smiled and rested her head against the doctor's chest. After a while, he guided her from the music room. At once, Matt was out of his hiding place. He sniffed the glass and sampled the contents. Ugh, it tasted like rotten fruit. He spat it out at once. He listened carefully for footsteps outside in the hall and sat down at the piano. He carefully pressed a key. The note rang softly in the music room. Matt was entranced. He tried other keys. They were all beautiful. He was so enchanted he almost didn't hear the servant coming down the hall, but fortunately, he woke up soon enough to scuttle behind the potted plants. After that day, Matt studied the comings and goings of the servants to work out when it was safe to visit the music room. Felicia never used it in the morning. In fact, she didn't get up until the afternoon and was active for only an hour or so then. Matt discovered he could recreate the songs Celia sang to him, using one finger. Felicia used all 10, but he hadn't figured out how to do that yet. Even so, the ability to create music filled him with a joy too large to contain. He forgot where he was. He forgot he was a clone. The music made up for everything. The silent contempt of the servants, Stephen's and Emilia's snubs, Tom's hatred.
"So, this is where you get to," said Tamlin.
Matt swung around, almost tumbling off the bench.
"Don't stop. You've got real talent there. Funny, I never thought of El Patron as being musical."
Matt's heart was beating wildly. Was he going to be barred from the room?
"If you're musical, he must be," said the bodyguard. "But I guess he never had time to study. Where he lived, they chopped up pianos for firewood."
"Can you play?" asked Matt.
You must be joking. Look at these.
Matt saw stubby fingers sprouting from large, awkward hands. Some of the fingers were crooked, as though they'd been broken and healed again.
You could use one finger, he suggested.
Tamlin laughed.
Music has to be in the head first, laddie. The good Lord passed me by when he was handing out talent. You've got it, though, and it'd be a shame not to use it. I'll talk to El Patron about finding you a teacher.
This proved difficult. No human wanted to teach a clone, and no Egypt was smart enough. Finally, Tamlin found a man who had gone deaf and was desperate for work. It seemed odd to Matt that someone who couldn't hear could teach music, but so it was. Mr. Ortega felt it through his hands. He placed them on the piano as Matt practiced and caught every mistake. It wasn't long before Matt added musical ability to his growing list of accomplishments. He could read 10 years beyond his level, do math that left Tamlin bewildered and irritated, and speak both English and Spanish fluently. In addition, his art grew better by the day. He threw himself into studying everything that came before him. Matt could name the planets, the brightest stars, and all the constellations. He memorized the names of countries, their capitals, and chief exports. He was in a rage to learn. He would excel, and then everyone would love him and forget he was a clone. Chapter 10. A Cat with 9 Lives.
You're like a wild animal, complained Maria as she stood in the doorway of Matt's room. You hide in here like a bear in a cave.
Matt looked indifferently at the curtain windows. He liked the safe, comfortable darkness.
I am an animal, he replied.
Once those words would have pained him, but he accepted his status now.
I think you just like to wallow, said Maria, striding in to open the curtains and windows.
Outside lay Celia's garden filled with stands of corn, tomatoes, beans, peas.
Anyhow, it's El Patron's birthday, and that means you'd better take that snarl off your face.
Matt sighed. He could unnerve almost everyone by growling at them, but not Maria. She only laughed. Of course, he never dreamed of growling at El Patron on those rare occasions when the old man visited. To do so would have been unthinkable. Each time El Patron looked more frail, and his mind seemed less in order.
It broke Matt's heart to look at him. He loved El Patron. He owed everything to him.
Matt could hardly remember those terrible days 3 years before, when he was kept in a pen with roaches for friends and old chicken bones for toys. But he knew he'd still be there, or buried under the floor by Rosa, if the old man hadn't rescued him.
El Patron's 143 today, said Matt.
Maria shivered.
I can't imagine being that old.
Celia said if they put that many candles on the cake, it would melt the paint off the walls.
He was kind of strange last time he was here, said Maria.
That's one way to put it, thought Matt. El Patron had become so forgetful, he repeated the same sentence over and over again.
Am I dead yet?
He asked.
Am I dead yet?
And he held his hand before his face, studying each finger as though to reassure himself that he was still there.
Are you ready?
Cried Celia, rushing into the room. She made Matt turn and adjusted the collar of his shirt.
Remember, you're sitting next to El Patron tonight. Pay attention and answer all his questions.
What if he's weird? Said Matt. He remembered answering the question, Am I dead yet? Over and over the last time the old man visited. Celia stopped fussing with the shirt and knelt before him.
Listen to me, darling. If anything bad happens tonight, I want you to come straight to me. Come to the pantry behind the kitchen.
What do you mean, bad?
I can't say.
Celia looked furtively around the room.
Just promise me you'll remember.
Matt thought it was hard to promise something like that. Nobody planned to forget. But he nodded.
Oh, mi hijo, I do love you.
Celia flung her arms around him and burst into tears. Matt was both startled and dismayed. What could have upset her so much? He saw Maria out of the corner of his eye. She was making a face that indicated how totally soppy she found this display. That was Maria's favorite word recently, soppy. She'd picked it up from Tamlin.
I promise, Matt said.
Celia sat back abruptly and wiped her eyes with her apron.
I'm a fool. What good would it do if you understood? It would only make things worse.
She seemed to be talking to herself, and Matt watched her anxiously. Then she stood up and smoothed the wrinkles in her apron.
Run along, chicos, and have fun at the party. I'll be in the kitchen serving up the best dinner you ever saw. You look wonderful, both of you, like you stepped out of a movie.
The old confident Celia was back, and Matt was relieved.
I have to get Furball from my room, said Maria after they left.
Oh, no, you can't take him to dinner.
I can if I want. I'll hide him in my lap.
Matt sighed. There was no point arguing with her. Maria took Furball everywhere. Tamlin complained that it wasn't a dog, but a hairy tumor growing out of her arm. He offered to take her to a doctor and have it removed. Tom was in Maria's room, and Furball was nowhere to be seen.
You didn't let him out,
cried Maria as she looked under the bed.
I never even saw him, said Tom, glaring at Matt.
Matt glared back. Tom's bristly red hair was slicked down, and his fingernails were neat white crescents. Tom was always perfectly groomed for these occasions, and it earned him many admiring comments from the women who came to El Patron's birthday parties.
He's lost, wailed Maria. He gets so scared when he's lost. Oh, please, help me find him.
Reluctantly, Tom and Matt left off their glaring contest and began looking under pillows, behind curtains, in dresser drawers. Maria whimpered softly as the hunt dragged on without any results.
He's probably running around the house having a great time, said Matt.
He hates being outside, said Maria, weeping.
Matt could believe that. The dog was such a loser that he ran from sparrows. But he probably was outside hiding in any of a thousand places. They'd never find him before dinner. Then something odd struck him. Tom. Tom was searching, but he didn't seem to be really looking. It was hard to describe. Tom was going through the motions, but all the while his eyes were watching Maria. Matt stopped what he was doing and listened.
I hear something, he cried.
He dashed into the bathroom, lifted the toilet lid, and there was Furball, so waterlogged and exhausted he'd been able to utter only the faintest whine. Matt pulled the dog out and dropped him hastily on the floor. He grabbed a towel and wrapped up Furball. The dog was so tired he didn't even try to bite. He lay perfectly limp as Maria snatched him up.
How did he get in there? Who put the top down? Oh, darling, sweet, sweet Furball.
She cuddled the revolting creature next to her face.
You're okay now. You're my good dog. You're my honey bunch.
He's always drinking out of the toilet, Tom said. He must have fallen in and pulled the lid down on top of him. I'll call a maid to give him a bath.
He went out, but not before Matt saw a flash of real anger on his face. Tom had wanted something and hadn't gotten it. Matt was sure Tom had dumped Furball in the toilet, although he'd never shown dislike for the dog before. That was like Tom, though. He could be courteous and helpful on the surface, but you never knew what was going on underneath. Matt felt cold. Furball would have drowned if he hadn't found him. How could anybody be that cruel? And why would anyone want to hurt Maria, who was so tender-hearted? She rescued Black Widow spiders. Matt knew no one would believe him if he accused Tom. He was only a clone, and his opinion didn't matter. Or it didn't matter most of the time, Matt thought, as a delightful plan occurred to him. Most of the time, the servants ignored Matt, and the Alacrans looked past him as though he were a bug on a window. Mr. Ortega, the music teacher, rarely said anything to him except,
"No, no, no,"
when Matt struck a wrong note.
Mr. Ortega didn't say, "No, no, no," very often now.
Matt was an excellent piano player, and thought it wouldn't have hurt the man to say "good" now and then, but he never did. When Matt played well, an expression of joy crossed Mr. Ortega's face that was as good as a compliment, though. And when Matt played really, really well, he was too enraptured to care what the music teacher thought. Everything changed during the annual birthday party. It was really El Patron's party, but it had developed into a celebration for Matt as well. At least Celia, Tamlin, Maria, and El Patron celebrated for him. Everyone else just gritted their teeth and got through the day. It was the one time when Matt could ask for anything he wanted. He could force the Alacrans to pay attention to him. He could make Stephen and Tom, yes, Tom, be polite to him in front of their friends. No one dared to make El Patrón angry, and therefore no one dared to ignore Matt. Tables were set for the party in one of the vast gardens surrounding the big house. The lawn was flawlessly smooth, with the grass all of the same height. It was cared for by Egypts, who trimmed the ground with scissors just before the event. It would be trampled into oblivion by tomorrow, but now it glowed like a green jewel in the soft afternoon light. The tables were covered with spotless white cloths. The dishes were trimmed with gold. The silver cutlery was freshly polished, and a crystal goblet sat by each plate. In a corner, under a bougainvillea arbor, sat an enormous stack of presents. Everyone brought gifts to El Patrón, although there was nothing he didn't already own, and not much he could enjoy at the age of 143. There were even a few presents for Matt. Small, loving tributes from Celia and Maria, something useful from Tamlin, and a large, expensive gift from El Patrón. The guests wandered around, choosing delicacies brought to them on trays by the maids. Waiters offered drinks of every description and brought water pipes for those who wished to smoke. There were senators and famous actors, generals and world-renowned doctors, a few ex-presidents, and half a dozen dictators from places Matt had heard about on TV. There was even a faded-looking princess. And of course, there were the other farmers. The farmers were the real aristocrats here. They ruled the drug empire that formed the border between the United States and Aztlán. The farmers stood in a knot around a man Matt hadn't seen before. He had bristly red hair, a soft, doughy face, and deep circles under his eyes. He looked unwell, but in spite of that, he was in a good mood. He harangued the others in a braying voice and punctuated his statements by poking them in the chest with a finger. By that alone, Matt knew he must be a farmer. No one else would dare to be so rude.
"That's Mr. McGregor," said Maria.
She had come up behind Matt with a fluff-dried furball draped over her arm.
"Who?"
For an instant, Matt was back in the little house in the poppy fields. He was 6 years old, and he was reading a tattered book about Pedro el Conejo, who got trapped in Señor McGregor's garden. Señor McGregor had wanted to put Pedro into a pie.
"He has a farm near San Diego," said Maria. "Personally, I think he's creepy."
Matt studied the man more closely. He didn't look like Señor McGregor in the book, but there was definitely something unpleasant about him.
"They're signaling everyone to go into the salon," said Maria.
She hitched Furball into a more comfortable position.
"You better not howl," she told the dog, "no matter how awful the company is."
"Thanks a lot," said Matt. The salon stood at the top of marble steps leading up from the garden. The party guests drifted toward it, dutifully obeying the summons to greet El Patrón. Matt braced himself for a shock. Each time he saw El Patrón, the old man had deteriorated more. The guests arranged themselves in a semicircle. All around the edge of the salon were giant vases of flowers and the marble statues so dear to El Patrón's heart. The conversation died down. The sounds of birds and fountains became clearer. A peacock shrieked from a nearby garden. Matt waited tensely for the hum of El Patrón's motorized wheelchair. Then, amazingly, the curtains at the far end of the salon parted, and El Patrón walked in. He moved slowly, to be sure, but he was actually walking. Matt was delighted. Behind the old man came Daft Donald and Tamlin, both pushing wheelchairs. A gasp echoed around the salon. Someone, the princess, Matt thought, cried, "Hip hip hooray!" Then everyone cheered, and Matt cheered too, filled with relief and joy. Someone behind Matt muttered,
"The old vampire. So he managed to crawl out of the coffin again."
Matt turned quickly to see who it was, but he couldn't tell which of the partygoers was guilty. When El Patrón reached the middle of the salon, he signaled for Tamlin to bring up his wheelchair. He sank down, and Tamlin stuffed pillows around him. Much to Matt's surprise, Mr. McGregor came forward and sat in the other wheelchair.
"So they are friends," Matt thought. Why hadn't he seen Mr. McGregor before? "Welcome," said El Patrón. His voice wasn't loud, but it commanded instant attention.
Welcome to my 143rd birthday party. All of you are my friends and allies.
Or family members. The old man laughed softly.
I imagine they hope to see me in my grave by now, but no such luck. I've had the benefit of a marvelous new treatment from the finest doctors in the world. And now my good friend McGregor is going to be treated by these same people.
Mr. McGregor grinned and held up El Patron's arm as a referee would hold up a victorious boxer's arm. What was there about the man that was so repulsive? Matt felt his stomach knot, and yet he had no reason to dislike him.
Come forth, you miracle workers, said El Patron.
Two men and two women separated themselves from the crowd. They approached the wheelchairs and bowed.
I'm sure you'd be satisfied with only my heartfelt thanks, El Patron chuckled as the doctors tried to hide their disappointment. But you'll be even more satisfied with these $1 million checks.
The doctors immediately cheered up, although one of the women had the grace to blush. Everyone applauded, and the doctors thanked El Patron. Tamlin caught Matt's eye and nodded to him. Matt stepped forward.
Mi vida,
said El Patron with real warmth. He beckoned with his gnarled hand.
Come closer and let me look at you. Was I ever that handsome? I must have been.
The old man sighed and fell silent. Tamlin indicated that Matt was to stand next to the wheelchairs.
I was a poor boy from a poor village,
El Patron began, addressing the assembled presidents, dictators, generals, and other famous people.
One year during Cinco de Mayo, the ranchero who owned our land had a parade. I and my five brothers went to watch. Mama brought my little sisters. She carried one, and the other held on to her skirt and followed behind.
Matt saw the dusty cornfields and purple mountains of Durango. He saw the streams that roared with water 2 months of the year and were dry as a bone the rest of the time. He had heard the story from El Patron so often, he knew it by heart.
During the parade, the mayor rode on a fine white horse and threw money into the crowd. How we scrambled for the coins. How we rolled in the dirt like pigs. But we needed the money. We were so poor. We didn't have 2 pesos to rub together. Afterward, the ranchero gave a great feast. We could eat all we wanted, and it was a wonderful opportunity for people who had stomachs so shrunken that chili beans had to wait in line to get inside. My little sisters caught typhoid at that feast. They died in the same hour. They were so small, they couldn't look over the windowsill. No. Not even if they stood on tiptoe.
The salon was deathly still. In the distance, Matt heard a dove calling from the garden.
No hope, it said. No hope. No hope. During the following years, each of my five brothers died. 2 drowned. 1 had a burst appendix, and we had no money for the doctor. The last 2 brothers were beaten to death by the police. There were 8 of us, said El Patron, and only I lived to grow up.
Matt thought the audience looked bored, although they tried to conceal it. They had heard the same speech for years.
I outlived them all as I outlived all my enemies. Of course, I can always make more enemies.
El Patron looked around the audience and several people tried to smile. They met El Patron's steely eyes and he immediately sobered up.
You could say I am a cat with 9 lives. As long as there's mice to catch, I intend to keep hunting. And thanks to the doctors, I can still enjoy it. You can start clapping now.
He glared at the audience, and they began, first hesitantly and then loudly, to applaud.
They're just like robots,
El Patron muttered under his breath. More loudly, he said,
I'm going to take a brief rest, and then we shall all have dinner.
Chapter 11. The Giving and Taking of Gifts.
Matt wandered around the garden,
admiring the ice sculptures and a fountain of wine with orange slices bobbing in a red pool. He dipped his finger into taste. It wasn't as good as it looked. He checked the place cards on the tables and saw that he was, as usual, seated next to El Patrón. Mr. McGregor was on El Patrón's other side. The other favored guests were Mr. Alacrán and Felicia, Benito, back from college, or rather, expelled from college, and Stephen and Tom. Mr. Alacrán's father rounded out the guests at the head table. Everyone called him El Viejo these days, because he seemed even older than El Patrón. Humming to himself, Matt removed Tom's card and put it at the baby table. A nanny sat at each end to keep order, and high chairs were lined up on either side. Matt located Maria's card and placed it next to his. Next, Matt explored the edge of the garden, where the bodyguards formed a sullen, dark perimeter. Each of the presidents, dictators, and generals had brought his own protectors, and of course the Alagrangs had hired a small army for the party. Matt counted more than 200 men. Who were they guarding against, he wondered. Who was likely to come charging across the poppy fields? But Matt was used to bodyguards at all family affairs, and it seemed natural for them to be there. The sun was setting, and the garden was full of a cool green light. The Ajo Mountains still glowed purple-brown in the distance, and the poppy fields were tipped with a gold that faded even as Matt watched. Lamps went on in the trees.
"You pig,"
cried Maria, who had furball ensconced in a bag slung over her shoulder.
"Just once you could be nice to Tom. I've moved his card right back."
"I'm punishing him for trying to drown Furball," said Matt.
"What on earth are you talking about?"
"Furball couldn't have fallen into the toilet and pulled the top down. It isn't possible. Tom did it."
"He couldn't be that evil," said Maria.
"Since when?" "Anyhow, it's my party, and I get to say who sits where." Matt was beginning to lose patience with Maria. He was trying to be nice to her, and she was taking it all wrong.
"They eat mush at the baby table."
"Good," Matt said. He fetched Tom's card and replaced it. Maria reached for it again, and he grabbed her wrist quite hard.
"Ow! That hurts. I'm going to stay here."
"No, you aren't," said Matt.
"I'll do whatever I like."
Matt ran back to his table with Maria trying to push past him and grab her place card. El Patrón had arrived, along with McGregor and the others.
"What's this? What's this?" said El Patrón.
Matt and Maria skidded to a halt.
"I want her to sit next to me," said Matt.
The old man laughed, a dry, dusty sound.
"Is she your little girlfriend? Your novia?" "That's disgusting," said Mr. Alacrán. "Is it?" El Patrón chuckled. "Matt's no different than I was at that age. Matt's a clone. He's my clone. Sit here, girl. Make room for her, Tamlin."
Tamlin found a place setting for Maria. He frowned at Matt.
"Where's Tom?"
Felicia said. Everyone turned to look at her. Felicia was so quiet and so seldom seen, most people seemed to forget she existed.
"Where is Tom?" El Patrón turned to Matt.
"I put him at the baby table," said Matt. "You pig," shouted Maria.
El Patrón laughed.
"That's the stuff, mi vida. Get rid of your enemies when you can. I don't like Tom either, and dinner will be better without him."
Felicia balled up her napkin in her fist, but she didn't say anything.
"I don't want to stay here. I want to be with Tom," cried Maria.
"Well, you can't," Matt said flatly. Why did she always have to stick up for him? She didn't even stop to think. There was no way Furball could have pulled the lid down on top of himself. But she didn't believe Matt because he was only a disgusting clone. A dull rage at the unfairness of it swept over him.
"Do as you're told, girl."
El Patrón suddenly lost interest in the drama and turned to Mr. McGregor on his other side. Maria, choking back tears, was pushed up to the table by Tamlin.
"I'll see he gets the same food as the rest of us," he whispered.
"No, you won't," said Matt. Tamlin raised his eyebrows.
"Is that a direct order, Master Matt?"
Yes.
Matt tried to ignore Maria's soft whimpers as she strove not to draw attention to herself. If she couldn't bring herself to punish Tom, he would do it for her. Food was brought and served. Maria selected bits to feed Furball and continued to stare down at her lap.
Fetal brain implants. I must try that sometime, said McGregor. It's done wonders for you. Don't put it off too long, El Patron advised. You have to give the doctors at least 5 months lead time. 8 is better. I won't be able to use...
Oh, no. He's much too old.
Felicia was staring down at her plate with almost as much dejection as Maria. She wasn't even pretending to eat. She drank from a tall glass that was regularly filled by a servant. She looked pleadingly at McGregor, although Matt couldn't guess what she could want from him. In any case, he ignored her, and so did her husband, and everyone else for that matter. El Viejo, Mr. Alacrán's father, spilled his food and made a mess on the tablecloth. No one paid attention to him either.
See, there's an example of someone who didn't get his implants when he should have, said El Patrón, pointing at El Viejo.
Father decided against it, said Mr. Alacrán.
He's a fool, then. Look at him, Matt. Would you believe that's my grandson?
Matt hadn't worked out the exact relationship between El Viejo and El Patrón before. It hadn't seemed important. El Patrón looked ancient, no doubt about it, but his mind was sharp. At least now it was, after those whatever they were implants. El Viejo could hardly string a sentence together, and some of the time he sat in his room and screamed. Celia said that happened to some old people, and that Matt mustn't worry about it.
I could believe he's your grandfather, said Matt.
El Patrón laughed, spraying food particles over his plate.
That's what comes of not taking care of yourself.
Father decided implants were immoral, said Mr. Alacrán, and I honored his decision.
A sudden intake of breath around the table told Matt that Mr. Alacrán had said something dangerous.
He's deeply religious. He thinks God put him on earth for a certain number of years, and that he mustn't ask for more.
El Patrón stared at Mr. Alacrán for a long moment.
I'll overlook your rudeness, he said at last. It's my birthday, and I'm in a good mood. But someday, you'll be old, too. Your body will start to fall apart, and your brain will deteriorate. See if you're so high-minded then.
He went back to eating, and everyone relaxed.
May I check up on Tom?
Felicia said in her uncertain way.
Stay out of this,
growled Mr. Alacrán.
I only wanted to see if he had food.
For God's sake, he's capable of standing on his own hind legs and finding something to eat.
Those were Matt's sentiments, too, but he was surprised at the anger Mr. Alacrán showed toward Felicia. How could anyone get mad at her? She was so helpless. Felicia hung her head and withdrew into silence. After dinner, Tam Lin rolled El Patrón to the Bougainvillea Arbor for the gift-giving. Mr. McGregor excused himself because he had to rest up for an operation. Matt was glad to see him go. El Patrón set great importance on gifts.
You can tell how much someone loves you by the size of the present,
he often told Matt. He preferred to receive gifts rather than give them.
The flow of wealth should be from outside.
El Patrón opened his arms wide as though he were about to hug someone.
In.
El Patrón gave himself a big bear hug instead. Matt thought this was very funny. Daft Donald and Tam Lin brought the boxes to El Patrón. Matt read the cards and tore off the wrappers. A secretary recorded who had given what and the value of the gift. Watches, jewelry, paintings, statues, and moon rocks piled up on the lawn. Matt thought the moon rocks looked like something you could find anywhere in the Ajo Mountains, but they came with a certificate and were very expensive. The fated princess gave El Patrón a statue of a naked baby with wings, one of the few gifts he seemed to like. Matt gave him a wallet that had